Really, what we're trying to do is to try dissect those artisanal products in a manner where we're not necessarily looking to add in the 20 or 30 strains again, but to really find the core components that are reflective of the particular, say, kefir products that we're studying today, but also maybe all kefir products that we can get our hands on, to see what's common among all of those, but also what's unique about those and what aspects of those communities might be contributing to other attributes beyond biopreservation that perhaps might be involved in reducing cholesterol or helping to address anxiety and gut brain disorders or some other phenomenon relating to health.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organisation, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And our guest today is Paul Cotter from Chagas in Moor Park in Ireland. And just to, before I welcome you, Paul, just to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest here, Paul was one of my students back in the day. So he did his PhD in our lab, certainly one of the most talented students ever to go through our lab. And now he's forged a career for himself in Chagas and in UCC and APC Microbiome Ireland. And we have you on today, Paul, to talk about fermentations.
Yeah, great pleasure to be here. Thanks ever so much for the invitation and looking forward to the chat.
So tell us about fermentations. I mean, I was at a meeting recently where, I wish I could remember his name. He's a Dutch fermentation guy who said you can ferment anything. You just add salt and leave it alone and just about anything is fermentable. Do you buy into that or do you think there are some conditions that govern what is and what is not fermentable?
I guess if we focus on food in particular, I think societies have shown over millennia that they have managed to ferment just about every raw substrate that has been available. And typically, logically, those various different societies relied on whatever it was that was available to them and generally foods that were in excess. So if you think about milk, if you have too much of that milk, it will go off very rapidly. But if you can ferment it and generate a cheese or a yogurt or a kefir or whatnot, then the shelf life is much longer. And therefore, you're carrying out a preservation or a biopreservation to make that available over the subsequent weeks and months. And so that holds true for grapes and wine and various different grains and fish and meat and, yeah, just about every other fruit and vegetable that you can think of. So, yeah, and what's kind of interesting is that these all have evolved kind of almost in parallel. It's not that all of this happened in one location in the world and word was spread from there everywhere else. It was all of these societies kind of quite often by luck stored those foods in a particular way. And in many cases, the food went off. But in some other cases, it fermented in a desirable way that added flavor or added some other attributes or just simply preserved the food for longer. And that was regarded as being desirable for that community.
And you use the word luck. And I agree. I mean, there's an awful lot of luck in science and in fermentation, I'm sure. But isn't it the case that kind of the substrate just selects out from its environment what it needs? I mean, if I left, you know, a glass of milk on my desk and a glass of, I don't know, malted barley on my desk or something, inevitably almost, maybe it isn't inevitable, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like inevitable that the milk would go sour and that the barley would select for yeast. Is it inevitable or is there some agency involved here?
I guess that there would be, it's a combination of both. So yes, the substrate and what form of carbohydrate or protein or whatnot that's available will select out the microorganisms, but then also how you store that material, whether it's in an anaerobic environment or whether you add salt or some other ingredients or whatnot, will allow for a tweaking of that process. And so I guess while the original process might have been luck, there are multiple generations who subsequently tweaked all of that to perfect different attributes, whether that be the color or the flavor or the preservation time or how quickly the food would go off. So, and if you think about, I suppose we'd be very familiar in Western society with cheese and wine and how large those industries are, but the different tweaks and the different nuances associated with the textures and the flavors of those food, a lot of that was due to, I guess you could call it research and perfection that was developed through different families and different societies over the subsequent period.
Did your original work start with the bacteriocins, Paul? Like, were you specifically interested in the antimicrobial peptides that are produced by the bacteria in fermented foods?
Yeah, I guess I kind of came at fermentation in reverse. So Colin mentioned earlier how I did my PhD in his lab, and that was a really enjoyable period of my research career because Colin was a great mentor and he gave us great guidance, but also gave us great flexibility to pursue what it was that inspired us. So I was pointed in the direction of acid resistance in Listeria, so a bad guy that you can find in fermented foods. And so, but just exactly what was going on there and the mechanisms, we were allowed a lot of flexibility. And so we identified a number of different acid resistance systems, glutamate decarboxylase and others that I guess informed us as to why Listeria was able to survive in some foods and some fermented foods. So that triggered my initial interest. And then, as you say, I began a career in antimicrobial peptides and bacteriocins as a postdoc with Colin and with Paul Ross, a name that would be familiar with very many other people in the microbiome space and in fermented or in food microbiology. And so in subsequent years, we studied a particular bacteriocin called lactocin 3147. And it was notable, not only because of its antimicrobial capacity, but because it came from a strain that was isolated from a kefir grain. And so it's kind of, it's interesting how things come full circle. And then in the subsequent years, we've spent an awful lot of time here in my group in Chagas studying kefir and the various different microbes that are present in there and different attributes. So I guess, as I say, I came at it indirectly, but once I arrived here in Chagas, I was charged with setting up our DNA sequencing facility and the associated infrastructure, using it primarily to study the microbes that are present in the gut and in stool samples and whatnot and how food impact those. But once we had the technology, we thought, why not apply it to foods and food production environments? And so we've spent a lot of time interrogating those different microbial communities using those technologies as well.
Paul, I guess fermentation, like many areas of science and of production, moved from, you know, this kind of almost sporadic folk fermentations, but then it became industrialized and mechanized, particularly cheese manufacture, but I'm sure a lot of different, and wine and beer. Mm. It still had the artistic side to it, I think, a lot of those products, but it had to deliver on time. The pH had to be down by 4 o'clock in the afternoon or you missed your cycle and so on. And to do that, people started moving towards much more kind of defined fermentations where you added the bacteria deliberately that you wanted to create the organoleptic changes in the food and give you that preservative quality. So that was a very interesting time, I guess, to be a microbiologist while all that was developing. But do you think we're moving back now towards the more multi-species artisanal almost, but trying to match that up with industrialized production demands? Is it possible to do that, do you think?
Most definitely. And I think you've hit on what's, I guess, one of the core focus areas of our research lab. And so, as you say, you have the artisanal approach, which have been applied for hundreds and for, in the case of some foods, thousands of years, where the fermentation process took place, but not necessarily knowing what were the microbes involved and some level of control of the fermentation process. But it can be hit and miss. So the product that you generate today might not taste exactly the same as the one that you generate tomorrow. And yes, the industrialization of that process and the identification of particular strains was a very important step. But I think what's happened, and again, primarily maybe in the Western society, is that maybe we've gone a little bit too far in some instances, in that there's perhaps an over-reliance on a small number of specific starter strains that are made available by the larger starter companies. And while it makes for products that are very consistent and the one that you make today will be very similar to the one that's made next week and indeed next year, I think very often we do lose something through that process due to the over-reliance on maybe one or two strains in contrast to the artisanal product, which may have 20 or 30 strains in some instances. So really what we're trying to do is to try dissect those artisanal products in a manner where we're not necessarily looking to add in the 20 or 30 strains again, but to really find the core components that are reflective of the particular, say, kefir product that we're studying today, but also maybe all kefir products that we can get our hands on to see what's common among all of those, but also what's unique about those and what aspects of those communities might be contributing to other attributes beyond biopreservation that perhaps might be involved in reducing cholesterol or helping to address anxiety and gut-brain disorders or some other phenomenon relating to health. And so after we dissect those communities and identify the particular strains, the process then has been to recombine or recreate those communities, but in a relatively simple form, but not so simple that we're trying to boil it down to one or two strains, because I think quite often it's just not possible to recreate those features in just one or two strains. And in one instance, for example, that I very frequently refer to because we published a lot in this area, is that we've managed to recreate a kefir community that we know from the artisanal product was quite good at reducing cholesterol in mice. And the recreated community contained 5 bacteria and 4 yeast. And this new created or pitched community, as we refer to it, retained all of the original attributes in terms of reducing cholesterol, not just in mice, but we've still subsequently shown that that is the case also in humans, but in a manner that allows for scale up and making a consistent product. So you have the beauty of the artisanal product, but you can industrialize it and make it available to the whole world and not just the one individual that happens to have that kefir grain in their kitchen.
Your research, and you touched on a little bit, is sort of directed toward identifying how the fermented foods provide health benefits. Can you talk to us about some of the mechanisms that you've helped shed light on?
Yeah, happy to, Dan. So there are very many. So it can, in some instances, be attributable to the microorganisms themselves and the consumption of those microorganisms. So some of them, such as lactobacilli and streptococci, are microorganisms that very frequently inhabit the small intestine of the gut. That really is a bit of a black box in terms of our studies of the microbiome of the gut, because those locations are more difficult to access. But the few studies that have been performed do show that those species or those genera exist there. And that indeed, in some instances, after consuming, say, a fermented product, in particular a fermented milk, that the microbes from that milk can outnumber the microbes that were present in the small intestine initially. And so I think it's clear that those must be having a profound effect in that scenario. Now, what that effect might be there or subsequently in the large intestine can vary. It can be through colonization and interaction with the epithelial lining, education of the immune system, producing a metabolic product or carrying out metabolism, a metabolic reaction in that location and producing a metabolite that's impacting the host, are producing something like lactate, which is used by very many other microbes in the gut to then be converted to desirable components like short-chain fatty acids. So the microbes themselves can be doing desirable things. I also should have mentioned the capability of just the fact that breaking down lactose can be desirable in terms of individuals that are sensitive to lactose. And then you also, I touched on the metabolites already, but you can have the metabolites already being produced in the fermented product, such that even if you have a fermented food where the microbes have been inactivated due to heating or, say, pasteurization or some other sort of process, the metabolites might still be present and may still have a beneficial effect in the gut. The other feature that can be desirable relates to the digestive process, or in other words, what the microbes are doing to the food before we digest it. So it's almost like a pre-digestion of the food. And through that pre-digestion, if you think of protein, the protein's been broken down into peptides and amino acids and therefore are more bioavailable for our consumption. You can have the release of neurotransmitters such as GABA. And in some instances, you have allergenic compounds. I talked about lactose, but also gluten. In the case of some African fermented foods, the raw substrate can contain compounds that are toxic, and therefore those foods can't be consumed directly, but the fermentation process removes those and makes them safe to consume. So there's a broad variety of different things, different mechanisms via which the fermentation process can bring about desirable consequences.
And I know that the wonderful Eli Metchnikoff, who lived in the, what was it, the 20th and 19th centuries, I guess, and won a Nobel Prize for his work in immunology, he attributed the long life of, was it Bulgarian shepherds, to the fact that they drank a lot of yogurt and, you know, the prolongation of life, I think was the title of his one of his theses. Do you think there's any evidence to support that at all? You know, we were now much more sophisticated. And of course, there would have been a period during the 20th century and maybe this century where we'd have kind of smirked at those ideas. Do you think they too might be coming around full circle?
I would like to think so. Again, unfortunately, there a lot of the evidence is still somewhat indirect in that there just aren't enough clinical studies relating to fermented foods, but I think that's starting to change. For instance, there's one study that I'm very happy to be involved with at the moment. It's a EU consortium called Domino, whereby we're making a kefir product that we're generating on a large scale and sending to three different countries, to the UK, to France, and to Italy. And it's not just your standard fermentation food consumption study, but in this instance, the individuals will be consuming that product over 6 months. And so I'm very intrigued to see what the consequences there are. I think also, I guess more globally, and again, in thinking about Western society in particular, and the work of Justin Sonnenberg and others, where they suggest that as a consequence of a modern lifestyle and not being exposed to enough microbes, either as a consequence of cesarean section birth or lack of breastfeeding and HMOs to encourage the growth of desirable microbes, or maybe excessive sterility or overuse of antibiotics, that also maybe during that period there was a reduced consumption over the last 100 years of fermented foods and live microbes by virtue of greater levels of pasteurization and generating foods that have very long shelf life, but maybe not reflecting the sorts of foods that we as humans were consuming for millennia. So I'd like to think that the reintroduction of microbes into our diet has the potential to address some of those different phenomena that have been attributed to things like autoimmune diseases and asthma, psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease, and others. But the studies need to be done in order to prove that definitively.
I'd like to ask you about that, Paul, because you've done in-depth analysis of the peptides and of the metabolites, but you've also been involved in clinical research. And so I'm asking this as a statistician involved in clinical trials. What kind of outcomes impress you? Do you require that it has to be all the way at the patient, a patient-reported outcome about their symptoms improving, or are there intermediate markers like measures of metabolic composition or function or health or microbiome composition and function that just on their face you would consider really important evidence? Or is it I would imagine it's a combination of both, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it because I know you've wrestled with that.
Yeah, I think both. I think the latter type of studies are useful in terms of giving the insight or identifying the changes that are occurring to provide the sorts of insights that can then facilitate the more detailed investigations that you're talking about, where you're either trying to treat a disease or maybe trying to prevent a disease from developing. And I think even it may be the preventing is the more realistic target, or maybe the more easily commercialized aspect, because sometimes, unfortunately, in food science, you can nearly go too far in that if you have success in treating a disease through a food, all of a sudden it's not something that you can sell on a supermarket shelf any longer. It kind of goes into a different category. It's medicinal food then, and the market is much smaller, even if the profits can be greater per individual unit or item. So I think what we've been tending to target is to target scenarios like pre-diabetes, or having a scenario where somebody has an increased inflammatory profile, but not necessarily having IBD. And maybe also in those instances, those are the more realistic targets in that it's more easily achieved, whereas to expect fermented food to have a short-term profound impact on somebody that's suffering from IBD might be a big ask, given the lack of evidence that probiotics can have a benefit in those scenarios as well. So, but indeed, it is a little bit of a horses for courses scenario. It comes back to what particular food, what microbes, what metabolites are being produced, how we think it could be contributing to health on the basis of preliminary work using cell lines or bioinformatics or animal models. And then from that to maybe identify the individuals in society where we can get the best bang for our buck. And that ultimately is our goal, I think, whereby we're encouraging people, every person, to consume more fermented foods and to find out what food works best for them. But we in parallel are trying to identify foods that are tailored for particular individuals so that, yeah, as I said earlier, in terms of the kefir that I make in my kitchen, maybe one that reduces cholesterol, but that might not be appropriate for me because my cholesterol levels are low and I exercise to a reasonable degree. Whereas my next door neighbor might have a kefir that's very good at controlling anxiety and stress. And maybe I need that because I'm dealing with 200 emails a day and the joys of academic research. And maybe that's the one I need. So it's getting the right fermented food and the right microbes to the right individual, I think, is where the future lies.
Domino sounds like an amazing project for people outside of Europe. These are these large, all across Europe, many countries involved in these projects. And I know you've just finished an amazing project, Master, and you were the coordinator of that. And, you know, the papers are just pouring out of that study from many labs around Europe. Tremendous piece of work. Can you describe that study or program a little bit to us, please? And what were the main findings?
Happy to. Yeah, so Master was a great pleasure. Typically, people that come through coordinating such a large EU project need to go to therapy for a few years thereafter. But in my instance, we really worked with a fantastic team who were really very inspiring to work with and very much dedicated to the success of the project. So it really, in my case, was bittersweet when it ended. I really enjoyed leading that. So Master had 30 different partners. So yes, it is a very unique European scenario. It was a mixture of academics, but also industry. And it was the type of project was, it was an innovation action, which may not mean much to most listeners, but what it means in the EU context is that it couldn't be research for the sake of research, but it had to be research that had innovations that had real-world applications, and that by the end of the project, or within a year or two of the project ending, that this research had the potential to impact society more general and be disruptive in terms of bringing about significant changes to the areas that we were working on. So the general concept underlying Master was that we would take the sort of tools that have been developed over the last decade or two to study the microbiomes in the gut and other environments and really start to apply them to a much greater extent to food and agriculture. And that might seem logical, but for many microbiologists and in particular the food industry, I guess there was a perception that while these new techniques that were used to study microbiomes in the gut, DNA sequencing and various different molecular approaches and whatnot were appropriate there because we couldn't grow very many of the microbes very easily in the lab and hence we needed those technologies. There was a perception that we could still rely on petri dishes and agars and broths and whatnot to grow the microbes in food and we could grow the vast majority of them. And it was really just a matter of how we chose to mix and match those microbes going forward. So we decided to apply these technologies to lots of different environments right throughout the food chain. I'll just note, but won't get into detail about some of the environments. So we looked at marine and fish farming and rumen microbiome and methane and soil and biopesticides and biofertilizers and really a broad investigation and application of molecular tools and probiotics and prebiotics and so on and so forth to all of those various different environments. But given that we're talking about fermented foods in particular today, the project and the study that was most significant from Master in that regard was one whereby we identified a number of different challenges relating to the application of those technologies to fermented foods. And one of them was in a scenario where you're finding new microorganisms, it sometimes can be very difficult to identify them. And for the food industry, in instances where they find something that's not a conventional lactococcus or streptococcus or so on, they may find something that's regarded as an unknown, and that's a challenge because you don't know if that microbe might be contributing to health or be associated with spoilage or disease or whatnot. So the big challenge was to generate a database that was populated with information about the sort of microbes you find in foods. And the only way of really doing that is to carry out a deep investigation of thousands of food samples from right across Europe. So we did that with multiple different industries. Hundreds of industries gave us multiple samples from the food production environment and from the raw materials and the final fermented foods and other foods. And we basically carried out DNA sequencing to an extreme degree and very in-depth sequencing to give us the information that we needed to populate that database and en route identified a multitude of not only new species, but new genera of bacteria and yeast and so on that had never been identified before. So it was like somebody not just going into the Amazon rainforest and finding a new species. It was like finding a whole new Amazon rainforest that we didn't know existed. So that was really amazing. We published a paper last year in Cell that's described in broad brushstrokes, the focus of the study, what we identified, the novel taxa and whatnot. But what we've been doing since then, even though the project has ended, there's still kind of a wave of publications to come, whereby we did a deep dive into that data to ask other questions, and that related to specifically, say, for example, particular environments or particular types of foods, like the cheese microbiomes or the microbiomes of fermented meats, and all that we can learn about that, or that we could study antimicrobial resistance genes or virulence genes, or we could identify completely new taxa. And with the new taxa, what we've been doing now is to go back to some of those foods and going beyond just DNA sequencing, but actually proving the concept by growing the microorganisms that we believe are novel and in those foods, and successfully culturing them and studying them and seeing how we might be able to use them in foods in the future.
So this is going to be just an extraordinary bank. I mean, strain bank, as you say, in your analogy, you know, if we could go and take every kind of seed you can find in the Amazonian forest and protect them, preserve them and catalog them. I mean, what a resource for future people working in this area. I'd really encourage people listening to this to read that paper in Cell. We'll provide a link to it in the show notes, but it's an extraordinary output and genuine congratulations on achieving that. We've run out of time, but Paul, thank you so much for your contributions. We really, really, really appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.